And joining us now is Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow with Preserving Bible Times out in the Washington, D.C. area. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Morning, Doug.
You've got a quote for us every time, and we look forward to that. Give us something to chew on today. What is your quote of the day?
Well, this one comes from a chap named Max Reich, R-E-I-C-H. And at one point, Max said the following: "The Christian who is careless in Bible reading is careless in Christian living." And what strikes me about that is when we read the Bible from often our one-dimensional Western 21st century postmodern viewpoint, we kind of only see about a one-dimensional understanding of many a passage. And if that's what we're doing, that can easily translate into living as disciples of Jesus in sort of a one-dimensional understanding in this world. And so the Christian who sees the full weight of a passage understands it from a Middle Eastern Jewish first century village agrarian perspective, is actually seeing more of Jesus and what he's saying and what he's doing. And that, I would suggest, translates into more of a three-dimensional understanding of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus and a Christian in today's world. So to me, the way we read the scripture, as Max Wright said, shapes the way we live the Christian life. And that's pretty significant.
And there's another aspect to this, too. And sometimes we read the Bible and we see the words, but we really understand only what we've been taught all our lives about it.
Or we understand what we project onto those words, which is typically what we've been taught in our past, and that may or may not be consistent with the original meaning of the text.
Yeah, it's like what we're thinking is already filtered for us, and maybe some of the good stuff is not there. It brings to mind a passage that has always been a mystery to me, because for the life of me, I can't figure why Jesus would say, "Come follow me," and they would just drop everything and go. I mean, there had to be some things leading, and I'm talking about Luke 5 now.
That phrase "follow me" is a Jewish rabbi idiom that means "come and be with me." That's the part we in the West really like, but it continues "and submit to my authoritative teaching." That's really what that phrase means.
Yeah, but what did Jesus hypnotize them? Did they know each other beforehand? Did they know what they were getting into? All that that setup to that is kind of missing in my mind. What happened in Luke 5?
Well, in Luke 5, it's really Jesus' first encounter with what's going to be disciples here after he's went back to Nazareth and read from the Isaiah 61 scroll and basically had a riot on his hands. And the way Luke constructs his narrative at the very beginning of Luke 5, let's just read those five verses here and then go back and revisit them slowly. "Now it happened that while the crowd..." We're in Capernaum on the seashore. "The crowd on the Capernaum seashore was pressing around Jesus and listening to the word of God. He was standing by the lake of Gennesaret," which is another name for Galilee. "And Jesus saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake, but the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And Jesus got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little away from the land. And Jesus sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, 'Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch.' Simon answered and said, 'Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets.' When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break." So I think the two of you might be intrigued, really intrigued with this story, living up in central Minnesota where you are with all those 11,000 lakes.
Fishing's a big deal here,
all the fishing that you do.
Well, it's 10,000 lakes and two fish is what it is.
Okay, I'm from Michigan.
Don't tell anybody that. Chamber of Commerce would frown.
In Michigan, where my home is, it's 11,037 lakes. So, you know,
can
we
count,
don't tout that too much.
Can we count puddles?
But here's the deal. You can never jump into a passage, or if you do, you lose something because there's probably something that's happened before that bears on this passage. We have a way of saying the past is always the prologue for the present passage. And so to really appreciate the setup to Luke 5, we have to jump back maybe six verses here to 4:38 in Luke, where we run across the following. Then Jesus got up and left the synagogue and entered Simon's home, which is only about 60 or 70 feet from the synagogue in Capernaum. Now Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they asked Jesus to help her. And standing over her, he rebuked the fever, and it left her, and she immediately got up and waited on them. And so Jesus and Simon have already had a prior encounter. And because Jesus, and we're going to be gracious here, did a good thing by healing Simon's mother-in-law, this culture is all about social reciprocity. If you do something good for me, I'm mandated to do something good for you. And so basically, Simon owes Jesus one in this social reciprocity culture. And that's the backdrop to our encounter with Jesus in 5. And that's going to play into this. Now, I need to make you guys professional fishermen in the Sea of Galilee. Do either one of you fish?
Oh, yeah. Now and then. I do. It's not a passion, but a pleasant pastime kind of thing. Yeah.
And you're probably fishing with lines and rods.
Monofilament. Right? Good old-fashioned monofilament. Yeah.
I eat fish. I don't catch them myself, but I do eat them. So.
Well, that's to be commended.
Okay.
Let somebody else do the work. Yeah, David.
Mm-hmm. Here's how you are. I can make you an expert on fishing in the Sea of Galilee. First off, you only fish at night. And you'll notice whenever fishing is made reference in the Gospels, it's always at night. And that's because of the nature of the nets that they are using. Now, you made a reference to monofilament, that's nylon, but nylon didn't get to the Sea of Galilee until 1954.
Oh.
So the first question we have to ask is, what kind of nets are they fishing with? And so I'll make that my first quiz question.
Well, what did they have? They must have had, I don't know if they had cotton, Egyptian cotton, linen. Isn't linen made from cotton?
Oh, smart fella. Yes, it is linen, actually. It comes from the flax fiber.
Flax, okay.
And the thing about these linen nets, they're called trammel nets. Those are the entrapment nets that you use in the deep, is fish can see them during the day. And that's absolutely true. The dumbest thing you could ever do on the Sea of Galilee is fish with your trammel nets in the deep during the day. Everybody knows this never works. Has worked.
Wait a minute. I'm a professional fisherman here.
Right? I know that.
I'm Simon.
Now, there's something else about these linen nets. The longer they're wet, the more fragile they become. That's because they don't have a lot of inherent tensile strength, like nylon does. They get weaker and weaker the wetter and wetter they are. And so that's why after you fish all night, your first order of business is to bring those nets ashore, rack them, clean them, get the debris out of them, and let them totally dry before you go out the following night and do this all over again. All right? Everybody knows this to be true.
Well, now, Simon said that we've been fishing all night, didn't catch anything, so he's at work with his crew there, apparently.
Well, yes.
He's doing what he always does.
Let me make you Simon and Andrew, and okay. If you fished all night and caught nothing, what kind of mood are you in?
I'm taking a nap.
Tired.
You can't wait to rack and clean and dry your nets, grab a quick breakfast, and go to bed.
Yeah.
That's your lifestyle.
That's my agenda. Yep.
You wake up in mid-afternoon, maybe play with the kids for a couple hours, and you go out and you do this all over again. So that's what's been going on. So this particular morning, after this very unproductive night, Simon is racking and cleaning and drying his nets and can't wait to get a breakfast and go to bed when he hears this new rabbi in town who's down on the beach with a growing crowd say, "Simon, I need your boat." Now, this boat is 27 foot long, about 7.5 foot across, and about 4 foot deep. It's a minimum four-person boat when you're actually out there sailing and fishing. And Jesus's crowd is growing, and so he needs to back away from the shore to get a better voice trajectory here so people can see him. And so he asks Simon for his boat, but Jesus never just asks you for your things. He wants you to come along with them. And so if you're Simon and Jesus says, "Simon, I need your boat and I need you in it," what is your instant reaction here to this request at this moment in time?
Hey, I've got a business to run here.
And I'm dead tired.
Yeah, and I've got my crew working to their fingers to the bone, and I've got to prepare to fish later tonight, and you're asking a big deal here. This is not a simple thing.
And that raises an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Does Jesus' call always come at convenient times?
Aha.
The answer is no. Are we ever totally ready and totally prepared in the way we see our own lives? Probably not.
But Peter's Simon's thinking, but I owe this guy one, right?
Exactly. So then Jesus knows this, and Simon knows this. This is the way the culture works, and Simon is going to say yes, and Jesus knows he's going to say yes. But Simon's got a real attitudinal issue, I would suggest, at this point in time, because rabbis don't teach 22-minute sermons and make 3 points.
That was a point right there, I think. Yeah.
Rabbis teach for as long as people will listen. So he's in for hours. Now, there's been some interesting speculation about how long did Jesus teach. And if you've been up on the seashore of the Sea of Galilee, which we are when we go up there in February on our Israel Contextual Study Program, we actually teach this passage on the seashore there. The boulders that are in that area are all black. They come from black basalt, which is a volcanic material. It's a soft rock kind of a thing. And in warm climates, if there are black objects, they absorb heat. And so in my own musing, I figured Jesus probably taught till about noontime, because that's when those black rocks on the seashore where people would sit on really get hot. So that's just a curiosity. But there is a moment in time here. Let's say it's noon or 1 o'clock when Jesus finally says the Hebrew or Aramaic equivalent of amen. And Simon says, whew, I can't get to the rack here fast enough and go to bed. And Jesus says, Simon, get your nets and go out into the deep for a catch. Now, at this moment in time, you're Simon and Andrew. How are you feeling about this request?
I'm muttering under my breath about this rabbi guy.
Absolutely. Jesus has just asked him to do the most foolhardy thing that a fisherman could ever be asked to do in this culture.
In full public view, too.
Absolutely. The crowd is still there, and at least half this crowd is from Capernaum. They know Simon well. And this is a culture, again, that is all about honor and shame in addition to social reciprocity. If Simon is about to make a fool of himself, he will not live this one down for at least 10 years. So Jesus is doing something pretty interesting here. He's asking Simon to deal with his own pride issues. But even more than that, Jesus is asking him to put the assets of the business at risk because his nets are still moist. You just don't do this. And thirdly, everybody knows this will never work.
You can't
catch
fish.
So how are you feeling if you're Simon?
Can't catch fish. This is crazy. Mm. And what a professional embarrassment, a waste of time. I'm risking my investment here in these nets, and I'm asking my men, employees with me maybe, to do the same thing. This is not something I want to do.
And I would think that they're probably being paid shares as opposed to maybe, maybe not, I don't know.
It could well be. Those details are a little hazy. But here's now the question. What does Simon do with all of this stacked up against him?
Well, I'm wondering, too, if the public knows that Simon owes him one. If the story is circulated about this healing, that can't be kept quiet.
Well, I think the reciprocity thing sort of played itself out when Simon gave him the use of the boat.
No, he said, okay, we're even, huh?
Yeah, I would say in his view, it's now even. So he's got to view this request of Jesus on a different plane.
Well, this is something that occurs to me, too. If you're face-to-face with Jesus, there's got to be a commanding presence that you pay attention to. I mean, you know, Isaiah tells us there was nothing in his appearance to make him stand out. But to get obedience that quickly, I mean, he had to have something that made Peter do what he was asked to do.
Well, I would suggest two things. It's repeatedly noted in the Gospels that Jesus spoke with an authority like no other. So there must have been something in his presence, in his voice, when he said, Simon, get your nets and go out into the deep for a catch. That was motivational. Mm-hmm. But there's something else here, you know, and it took me 4.5 years to see it, even though it was right in front of my face, which is a good lesson Don't ever be in a hurry to leave these passages and trying to fathom them and to go deeper into them. But let me read it again, what Jesus says, and see if you can catch the reason why Simon agrees to do this. It's in verse 5 of Luke 5. And Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down your nets." Because previous to that, in verse 4, here's what Jesus says to Simon: "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Can you now see why Simon probably reluctantly but nevertheless chose to submit to Jesus' request?
He's doing it for payoff that he hopes will be there.
No.
No.
You just used the word hope. Do you think it's a hope issue?
Aha. He's taking action.
Jesus has made him a promise. See, this is the thing that I couldn't see for 4.5 years. I was teaching this passage out in California, and it was four services. And at the end of the third service, after teaching this, I sat down and I heard the Holy Spirit say to me, "You missed the promise." And I knew exactly what that meant, because Jesus said, "There will be a catch." Mm. That's the promise. Jesus didn't say, "Get your nets, go out in the deep, and this could be your lucky day." Or, "Get your nets, go out in the deep, and who knows what might happen." No, he says, "Go out into the deep, there will be a catch." And so I would suggest to you the reason, with all this stuff stacked up against him, Simon nevertheless agrees to do this is because he's caught the promise and he believes the authoritative nature of Jesus that this promise will come to be.
It takes the two. First of all, you assent to the authoritative voice, and then you respond affirmatively.
Exactly. And see, we also see faith here from a Hebrew perspective. It is an action verb. It's not a creed. It's not a philosophical position. Simon agrees to submit to the authority of Jesus when every fiber of his being says, "Not only will this not work, this is not even in my best interest." And yet he does it. Why? Because of the authoritative promise of Jesus. And this is a pattern I'm just beginning to see. This same pattern shows up in John 11 with the death of Lazarus and Mary and Margaret. Jesus is going to really stretch their faith, like he's stretching Simon's faith here. And when Jesus is going to stretch your faith, he tends to give you a promise. In Mary and Martha's case, he told the messenger, "You tell Mary and Martha that this is a sickness that will not end in death." Now, they didn't really believe that, but nevertheless, Jesus was going to delay his arrival into Bethany, and he gave him that promise ahead of time that this is an illness that will not end in death. And so this is a pattern that I'm saying just starting to emerge contextually as we continue to live and dig in these passages. And it's a lesson for us as well. Jesus often, through his scriptures and the prompting of his spirit, will give us a verse or two or three that we can cling to when it appears as if our faith is really going to be stretched.
Doug, are you familiar with the Russian porcelain eggs?
Yes, I am.
Eggs nested.
The Fabergé eggs?
Yeah, well, Fabergé or otherwise, but they're large, and there's a smaller one and a smaller one, all nested inside each other.
Oh, yes. We actually have a set of those here.
And I think there is an East Orthodox Church story behind that. But to me, the Bible is like that. Here we have 66 books written over a couple of thousand years by multiple authors, and yet there's a pattern to all of them. Like these eggs, there's stories within stories within stories, all repeating the same message. And you've uncovered another one for us. You've opened one of the eggs, teaching with those patterns, those types, those forms, reinforces the basic message over and over and over on an ever-increasing scale. To me, that's the most astounding thing about Scripture.
Yeah, and it's really interesting in the very next verse, having submitted to the authority of Jesus, Luke tells us they enclosed a great quantity of fish and their nets began to break. And if you're Simon at this moment in time, at least as I envision this, he says, "I knew it. I knew it. I never should have done this. I knew the nets would break. And now we're going to be cash flow negative for the next 3 weeks. This is not good for the business." And what he hasn't learned yet is that if you can trust Jesus for the catch, you can certainly trust him to bring it to shore. And he's going to learn those kind of things in the next 3 years.
Fascinating stuff, Doug. always.
Yeah, and there's another observation here, too. Yeah. It's very subtle. But he starts out as Simon in Luke's narrative. And then in verse 8, and when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." Simon is now Simon Peter. Now, that doesn't seem like much of a difference, but here it is linguistically. Simon means pebble, and Peter means rock. And so already the transformation of Simon from pebble to rock is underway, just by the way Luke slightly changes his name after this miracle.
Through obedience.
Yeah, absolutely. And obedience is a verb.
Doug, it's an astounding message, and we look to you for these aha moments continually, and we're grateful to you for providing them. This is just awesome material, and hope people are chewing on this right now, maybe running to their Bibles and going to Luke 5, or better yet, to Luke 4, verse 38, and starting there.
Well, here's a thought. Now that they now put down their nets and they become disciples of Jesus, there's a whole story there as well. But what's fascinating to me is now that these first disciples have been chosen by Jesus, what's the very first thing, the very next thing that Jesus exposes them to? And that's the very next passage in Luke here. And maybe for continuity purposes, we can pick that story of Jesus touching the leper up next week and look at the significance of why that's the very first thing that Jesus chooses to expose these brand new disciples to.
After they've brought in the fish, supposedly captured all these fish on Galilee. There's more to the story.
Well, there certainly is. In fact, we're going to deal with, I think now, which is the culmination of the story, which often gets missed because we don't always connect with the full contextual backdrop here. But as Luke says, amazement seized them and all his companions because of the great catch of fish. And then Jesus says in verse 10 of Luke 5, "Do not fear. From now on, you will be catching men." And that's the second promise. Why would they believe that promise? Because the first promise that he made about a great catch came to be true. And when they brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Now, this is where Jesus calls Simon and Andrew, and probably one or two more, to be disciples. These are the first disciples. And this is the most shocking part of the story if you're Simon and Andrew. And that is because of the way the rabbi-disciple relationship works in this culture. To press the rewind button a little bit here, when you're 5 years old, a boy goes to the local synagogue where they have the Bet Midrash, which is the school, the local school. And there, the lowercase rabbis will start to work with you to memorize the Old Testament. You'll start with the Pentateuch, and you'll work your way through the wisdom literature, and you'll end up with the prophetic literature. And hopefully you've memorized a good bit. Some will have memorized all of their Old Testament scriptures by the time they're bar mitzvahed at age 13. Now, the ones that do really well at this at age 13 are encouraged to go forward in 2 more years of study. But all of those who then wash out of the system at age 13 after their bar mitzvah are told by their teacher, "Go back to the profession of your fathers." And so only the cream is left after age 13. And for age 14 and 15, they will study the oral tradition and the wisdom of the sages. And at the end of age 15, the teachers will caucus again and determine now who's the best of the best, who's left. And they will be encouraged to now spend 2 more years to debate and to argue and to polish their ability to defend the scriptures and to argue points, et cetera, et cetera. And the other ones are told by their teachers, "Go back to the profession of your fathers." And so this goes on for 2 more years. Now we get to age 17, and there's another cut. So that what we're left with now are basically Rhodes Scholar kind of material. And everyone else is told to go back to the profession of your father. And those few, very few that remain, are now encouraged to walk with the rabbi for the next 3 years. Well, when they approach a rabbi, and say, may I be your disciple? He's not going to say yes immediately. He's going to say, walk with me for a week. I'm going to argue with you. I'm going to test you. I'm going to quiz you because I want to make sure you're worthy enough to be my disciple, because my purpose in life is to create disciples who are just like me. I, a rabbi, am going to create little rabbis, and I've got to make sure you're good enough to do that. So with that as a backdrop, okay, rabbis only choose the best of the best, the cream of the Rhodes Scholar, because disciples are supposed to emulate their rabbi in anything and everything that they do. You can now understand the shock of these guys who are back doing the profession of their fathers because they've washed out of the system. They didn't make the cut. Don't know whether it was at the junior varsity or college JV level, but we know they washed out. They're back to the profession of their fathers. They know they're not good enough. And Jesus comes along and says, follow me, be my disciple. Now, Jesus is a rabbi like no other rabbis. He's been doing exorcisms. He's been healing people. And Simon and Andrew know we can't emulate that. We have no capacity to ever be your disciple. We can't do those kind of things. And so that's all part of the backdrop here of the shocking ending of this story, where Jesus calls these guys to become disciples. And here we get the picture that what Jesus does is takes very ordinary people and makes them into extraordinary people in the power of his Spirit, and Pentecost is coming.
And then, again, there's this code word, come follow me. This is not let's hang out together. This is let's change your lives right now.
This is come and be with me and submit to my authoritative teaching. And so when Jesus later on will do something like the Sermon on the Mount, they have to submit to that. They have to make that part of their lives, and they have to make it part of their passion to try to live that way. And that's part of the challenge here, page after page, as we go through the Gospels, as these disciples, understanding how the system works, says, we're supposed to be able to do that? And time again, I'm sure they've looked at each other and said, what in the world have we gotten ourselves into?
You know, it says a couple things about Jesus, or suggests a couple things to me. I always want to qualify that, because you may teach me something here. But two things. One, Jesus doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of respect for the system as it exists there. And secondly, he's being inclusive as opposed to being exclusive, even though he chose these people specifically, I think, knowing what he could do for the kingdom in the coming years, because he's God on earth, certainly has an inkling of what's going to happen. He knows what he has to do, and these people have been specially chosen, but still it seems he's going to the lowest rung and finding worth and value there.
And I think that's a tremendous encouragement for us, because we are the Simons and Andrews of this world. And Jesus takes the very improbable people and empowers them to do impossible things.
Doug, it's been a terrific session this week. And
thank you.
Yeah, very much so.
Again, we'll look forward to next. You can be back with us on Wednesday next week. Does that work into your schedule?
It does, and we could call this one, He Touched Me, and we'll start to unpack these three verses about Jesus healing and touching first, and then healing the leper in Luke 5, 12 through 15.
It'll be a special day. Next Wednesday, 8 o'clock hour on Broken Road Radio. Doug, again, thank you. Doug with Preserving Bible Times. Again, their website, and you want to check them out and find out what's there for you. It'll be a treat. PreservingBibleTimes.org. Doug, have a terrific week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.